Welcome to This Justin, the show bringing you the latest advancements in healthcare, strategy, innovation, and public policy. And now, for the fastest voice in healthcare, here's your host, Justin Barnes.
The show will go on. Welcome to the special edition of This Justin Radio. I'm your host, Justin Barnes. Today we're broadcasting live from the Atlanta studios. As most of you know, we're supposed to be in sunny Orlando for the HIMSS 20 conference. But with that being canceled due to the coronavirus precautions, I could not be happier that we're still able to pull this show off. Many thanks to all of my guests that stuck with me and all of you to make this show happen today. Before we get too far, though, let me introduce you to my radio and on-air personality and producer, Stone Payton from Business Radio X. Welcome, my friend.
Thank you, sir.
It's great to have you here. Also in studio today is a great friend of the show and producer, Roberta Mullen, broadcasting us across the Healthcare Now radio network as well. Welcome, Roberta.
Thanks, Justin, for inviting me. I love being in studio with you.
Yeah, you're always a great personality here to have with us. Dr. Don Rucker from the ONC, National Coordinator. Excellent. Welcome to the show, my friend. Welcome back to the show, I should say.
Excellent. All right. Yeah, no, thanks, Justin.
You got it. Appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule. Obviously, you have a lot going on, probably more than anybody else, well, except for the CDC right now, maybe, going on with what you released yesterday and your team. So we're grateful for you joining us today. You have a great audience here of listeners. So I would, first of all, I'd like to offer you the floor to share some of your insights.
Thank you. First, I'd like to thank Karen and team because obviously, as Karen pointed out, the journey on interoperability has been a multi-year, almost an entire generation. When you go back, I was talking with David Brailer yesterday, 2004, when you know the Office of the National Coordinator started.
Yeah. Framework so for strategic action.
A long journey here to get that. I think the rule that we put out, the 21st Century Cures Act rule, is a major milestone. I think it reflects a couple big things. It reflects that while we've had, I think for a couple years, the bandwidth, the amount of electronic, now finally health information to actually have something to share, you know, we have not had the policy incentives because all of the policy incentives that we've put over into American healthcare, literally since 1942 Stabilization Act, during World War II, that made health insurance a pre-tax benefit, have put us where health care is under the control of third parties, as opposed to being a direct conversation with a patient, consumer, and a provider, you know, doctor, hospital. It has been a three-party conversation, and that, you know, conversation, because the economics are really under the control of everybody but the patient consumer, has been an increasingly expensive, increasingly unhappy situation. The Cures Act says, wait a minute, let's put some provisions in place that combined with modern computing will put the patients back in charge. And those provisions at top level, there are two big provisions. Technically, it says that the application programming interfaces, if you will, have to be allowed to work. They can't be hidden by, you know, contractual blocking or, you know, all the sneaky ways that you can sort of look like you're doing something but aren't.
Yes.
So they have to be real bona fide interfaces. On the one hand, Congress termed it APIs without special effort. And on the other hand, the information has to be shared for patients. The days when you can say, well, we're not really going to share the information because they're not in our network, or maybe even we'll share the information on a private network of, you know, where maybe the other members on that network are also high priced and also not really offering competitive solutions. Congress said those days are over. The patient controls where that information flows. Our rule makes that law, you know, puts that the law into effect. It happens over a couple of year time frame. You have Steve Posnack on soon, I believe, to talk about the details. But anyway, that's the top level. We're very excited, as Karen mentioned. We think this will be one of those things we look back on as an absolute game changer in getting the American public back in the control of healthcare. And certainly, I think, as everyone knows, President Trump strongly believes that the American public should have the ability to shop for their health care.
Yes. So what are some of the major takeaways for providers, do you feel, from this rule?
Well, I think there's a couple big takeaways for providers. I think, first of all, you know, there's a lot of brouhaha about the rule, obviously a lot of lobbying, a lot of business models that need to get rethought. And, you know, maybe this is a forcing function for business models, especially the non-transparent business models that have to be rethought. But ultimately, what is required of providers? What's required of providers is an unattended endpoint to their EMR secured by security provisions that I think Steve will tell you about in great detail. But it's a pretty straightforward thing. You basically have a server on the internet is ultimately what this is. So unlike some of the prior rules where all kinds of physician and hospital behaviors had to change, which is quite hard to do, this is really taking the data you already have that's already formatted and making that available on a secure API to the public, which means you hook up a computer to the internet that has an API. That's the mechanics of providers. What I think it really means is that providers can start thinking about a new world, a big data world, about having new insights into what they do, new control over their data. We've heard from some of the most sophisticated providers in America that they don't even have control of their data. They don't even have effective access to their data to do what they want. We think that's going to be powerful as a practical matter. Having these APIs will mean that a lot of the huge burdens that are forced on providers with our dysfunctional payment system can start going away, right? If payers can get the data and really see what providers are doing, we can really think about eliminating all this faked up documentation for, you know, to get a higher CPT code. We can, if we have all of the data, we can basically think about stop playing the quality measure game, right? The quality measure game is because we have no other way of evaluating value. That's why we started doing this 20 years ago, roughly.
Right.
Now, with these APIs, you're going to have many ways of evaluating value. Another payment game that will just, I think, over time, melt away with data is the whole prior auth business. So these are huge burdens on providers that just destroy the provider quality of life. You know, horrible terms like pajama time. And these APIs are the pathway to make this kind of hand-entered, manually curated, no value add data entry, this clerical work, basically melt away. It's going to be great for providers, I believe, over time. It will, however, force them to think about transparency and customer service in a new way.
It's fantastic. Roberta, you have a quick question?
Yeah, I do. This is Roberta from Healthcare Now Radio. Hi, Dawn. You brought up Braler. I was reading about that the other day, and one of the missions of ONC has always been patient access. This is like a decade and a half later. This rule will come out. What do you think? Mission accomplished or one small step?
Without getting into the history of the phrase you've cited in American political dialogue.
Right.
They're both very famous.
So without getting into that, I think it, you know, more concretely, I think what it says is in a world where we have not economically empowered the consumer, right, in our business models, the healthcare, though that's changing, high deductibles, employers are shifting more and more of the costs back on consumers. Even, you know, Medicare puts lots of costs on their patients when you get right down to it.
Right.
As we are shifting these costs back to the American public to get some control of the cost, we are fundamentally giving the public an entree into modern tools to make those decisions, both in terms of choice of what to do and then how to shop for what you've decided to do. So I think it has been the missing ingredient here. I think it's going to be very powerful.
No, excellent. Dr. Rucker, thank you very much. I know you have a busy day and a busy afternoon, so we certainly appreciate you joining the show today. Thank you for everything you do. We appreciate it greatly.
Oh, no. Thank you. Great talking to you guys. Sorry we couldn't do it in Orlando.
You got it. This is the second best, though. We're grateful. Thank you. And I think Stephen Posnack is on the line, Deputy National Coordinator.
You got it.
And I'm sure it's been a crazy, I can't imagine what you're going through. Never mind all of us just kind of scrambling. You've had to not only scramble, but you've had to do a lot of work over the last 6 to 12 months to 5 years so to get us here.
Yeah, those are all appropriate units of measure.
Exactly. So first of all, thank you, my friend, for taking time out of your busy day to join us. So we'll kind of dive right in. I'd like to actually give you kind of the floor and let you hit on some of your high points. We'll have a couple of follow-up questions, but I really know there's some real important pieces that you want to get out to a large audience today. So I'll kind of give you the floor and some of your high points from the new rule.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. And just to follow on to Dr. Rucker's remarks, unlike the other rules that we've worked on in the past, this one is both larger, obvious statement, but also has a much more transformative impact that we feel will make to the entire healthcare industry as a whole, both to enable patient access, but also to give providers better choices in terms of how they use the technology that they have available to them. One thing I wanted to be clear, which is certainly one thing that got brought up as part of the rulemaking process, was stakeholders' request for more time to understand and comply with the rules. Obviously, information blocking is a new legal and regulatory paradigm. And so what we did was to allow for more time for education and preparation in the beginning. So for the first 6 months, there are no compliance requirements up front, to just say that colloquially. And then over time, there's a gradual phase in for the information blocking scope and obligations overall on industry stakeholders. So we hope that will give a gradual way for everyone to come into compliance with the rules, and answers a lot of the concerns about having this apply come day one when the rules become effective. Similarly, on the certification program side, and that's probably the other important point to make, is that our rule is really two rules in one. A portion that applies to health IT developers only in terms of updates to our certification program, and then a portion that applies to health IT developers, health information exchanges and health information networks, and healthcare providers, which is the information blocking related provisions. So when it comes to changes to our certification program, again, only applicable to certified health IT developers, there are a number of changes there, some of which, as we visited last time I was on, and as Dr. Rucker mentioned, relate to benefits that will ultimately accrue to healthcare providers in getting more confidence and assurance in their products. Congress required that real-world testing be performed of those products, and that's one of the things that we've subsequently included in that final rule as well. So happy to turn it over to you, ask any more questions.
Sure. So I think the biggest thing, and you guys did a great job with your infographics, I will commend the office. You guys do a great job sharing very complex information as simply as possible. So certainly I'll encourage my audience to go out there and look at your website. First of all, go give us your URL really quick, the short and sweet one for the website or these key time.
Yeah, absolutely. So healthit.gov will always get you to the right place, but it's /cures rule is the extra to add on to healthit.gov. /cures rule.
Yep. And if you're on Twitter, it's #ONCCuresRule.
Cures Rule ONC.
Yes, Cures Rule ONC.
Perfect. Cures Rule ONC.
Yeah. So that's right. In the beauty of picking out what hashtag to do, we noticed that there would be two C's if we did it in a certain way. So we put our name last.
Excellent. Very smart.
You are up on the Twitter, Steve.
Yes, he is. So.
Yes, that is true.
Did a great job. So what are some of the key timelines there that you want to share specifically, Steve, with my audience and our audience today?
Yeah, absolutely. And there is one of those fact sheets that you mentioned that lays out a highlighted version of some of the milestones. So, first and foremost, I'll stay with information blocking because that one's a bit simpler.
Yep.
From a timeline perspective. You have the first 6 month period, which is when compliance with information blocking would be set to begin. Between month 6 and month 24, the only data that all of the what we call covered actors are responsible for not information blocking is the U.S. core data for interoperability, which is that new standard that we adopted, a new core data set. Yep. And that's how we helped to create this kind of gradual and incremental approach for stakeholders to adjust to the rules over time. So between month 6 and month 24, only the U.S. CDI is in scope from an information blocking perspective. And then at year 2 and beyond, that's when the full scope of, as we've defined, quote unquote, electronic health information is in place. And that's really, to say it no more simply than that, that's how information blocking lines up from a timing perspective. When it comes to certification, some of those rules become effective 60 days after the rule is published. And one bit of clarification I can note here, even though we released the rules publicly yesterday, they are not officially published in the Federal Register yet in that tri-column format. So everyone has a bit of a warm-up and stretching period before the official start date and starting line is laid out. And that'll be when the rules are published in that tri-column format from the Federal Register. So when it comes to health IT developers, they've got a number of different timelines along the way, but the one that I'll emphasize most will be that two-year milestone where, just like with information blocking, the U.S. core data for interoperability, that standard has been updated into a number of different certification criteria, including the new secure standards-based API certification criterion that Dr. Rucker mentioned, and that will be needed. Health IT developers will need to roll those out products certified to that criterion to their provider customers within that two-year period of time. So in very short order, in the grand scheme of things, all of us as patients will be able to use smartphone apps to connect to these standardized and certified APIs.
Excellent. Did you have a follow-up question, Roberta?
I did, Steve. Tell us a little bit about the industry in itself. You've been putting this out for a year now, the proposed rules have come out and everything. What do you think the vendors, are they prepared? How prepared are they to actually doing the integration of apps?
Yeah, so it's a perfect question. I think preparation it always goes on a spectrum. We've looked at some numbers and certainly have done some data briefs and blog posts in the past about industry adoption of FHIR. And that was, with regard to the release 2, which is the Argonaut version original. Many of those health IT developers, which you look at the data, occupy a large provider market share. Many of those health IT developers have been in motion and moving toward FHIR release 4, which is what we adopted in the final rule as the sole kind of API-based standard. So from that perspective, they've been, I think, relatively well prepared to move in that direction. There are a few other areas where we gave them more time to make adjustments relative to our certification requirements. I think the biggest adjustment for them overall is looking at their processes, looking at some of the business arrangements that may be different or may need to be adjusted as they start to go through the conditions of certification and the changes that Congress directed us to make to our certification program. And I think, some that have been tracking along with our regulation from the proposed rule stage, even dating back to, the Health IT Advisory Committee, and other comments that we received should be well positioned to comply with our rules in I don't want to say short order, but along the timeline that we've laid out. And as you mentioned, for the infographics and other fact sheets that we've put together, that's our attempt to get everybody else up to speed as quickly as possible.
You guys did a great job. I went through a lot of that yesterday. I sat on as many calls as I could. And I think just some of the feedback that I've been getting from the industry, it's very accommodating. And so I think you guys have done a phenomenal job handling a very difficult and tough piece of legislation. So phenomenal job, Steve and team.
Mm-hmm. And audience, follow him on Twitter.
Yes. Great insight.
I say it all the time.
Yes, you do. Yes, you do.
Come for the policy, stay for the gift, right?
That's right. I believe he calls FHIR muy caliente. His newest
one. That's right. My Spanish teacher would be proud.
Awesome. Steve, always a great guest. Thank you so much, my friend. I know you have a busy afternoon, so we'll let you go. I believe we have Elise Sweeney Anthony joining us now, but thanks again, Steve. All the best.
All right, a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Take care, buddy. Elise, are you on the line?
I am. Hello, Justin. Thanks for the invite. Happy to join.
You got it. Welcome back to the show. Executive Director, Office of Policy at the ONC. And I know that your schedule, I can't imagine what you what you're in the middle of right now. So we're grateful for you and for your time. Thank you.
Absolutely. Happy to do it. Happy to do it.
Thank you. So I'll kind of open it up. I gave Don and Steve the floor. I know you guys have a lot to cover. The floor is yours. So I'll kind of ask you maybe some follow-up questions, but I'd love if you're going to get a couple of points, significant points across, you can have the floor.
Sure. Thank you. So I guess I want to start out by saying thank you. You know, we've been working on the final rule for quite some time, as you can imagine.
Yes.
We received more than 2,000 comment submissions on our rule, and that's from across the landscape, from individuals to organizations, to developers, to app developers, just across the landscape. And all of that feedback really helped us to get to where we are now. You know, as I say, you know, we read every single comment. A lot of people talk about the length of the rule. But of course, one of the things we do is we respond to those comments. So we talk about, this is what we heard, or this is what you asked us about, and here's our response to it. But altogether, all of those comments really help us to inform the final policy and get to a place where what we're doing not just works in terms of what we want to achieve from a policy basis, but also works on the ground on what is needed for patients, providers, and the ecosystem as a whole. So I want to start by just saying thank you in that respect. A couple of things I'll highlight is I want to talk a little bit about the information blocking provisions, because we've received a ton of different comments around how it should be set up or the exceptions that we laid out. And all of that feedback really helped us to come to the right place. And we proposed 7 exceptions. We actually ended up with 8 exceptions. And that last exception on content and manner is really key, because it allows an opportunity for the health IT user and the developer to engage and to see if they can come to a common place in terms of that electronic health information, as we call it, that needs to move. But we also include, if that doesn't work, a way for that information to move. And we start by looking at standards-based mechanisms for that. And our goal overall is to make sure that the information is moving securely and appropriately. And the way we've laid out the information blocking exceptions are designed just to do that. So that's one place that I would direct folks to. I heard earlier talking about the website, and I'm glad it's working for folks. There's definitely a section in there on information blocking. We'll also be doing a webinar on information blocking, and I know that's the area of keen interest among any, so please do check that out.
Yes.
So I'll start there, but feel free to ask me questions.
So I guess my first question, kind of a big question, but what are some of the major changes from the proposed rule? A lot of us were very familiar with the proposed rule, and now we're scouring through the final rule. But what are the maybe 2 or 3 things that you would highlight that we should really know?
Well, one I would say is, you know, across the rule, we took into consideration a lot of the comments we received. Just to stay on the information blocking side for a little bit, we heard a lot about the definitions of health information network and health information exchange. And as folks who have been following this closely know, there are actors that Congress has identified under the information blocking section. So in other words, a potential information blocker could be a health information network, a health information exchange, a healthcare provider, or a certified health IT developer. So one of the things we heard a lot about were the definitions that we use in the information blocking provisions. And that's exactly what we wanted. When we put out a proposed rule, our goal is to hear what folks are thinking, to hear whether this will work on the ground, to understand where we may have missed something or where we may have gotten it right. So what we did is we updated some of those definitions in the information blocking side. We updated health information network and health information exchange to make it one combined definition that meets the goals that we're trying to achieve. Another component that we heard a lot about was thinking about the movement of information and the mechanism in which it moves. And that actually led to the creation of that new exception I talked about, which is the content and manner exception. So that's another piece as well. We also fine-tuned the structure of the fees exception and the licensing of intellectual property exceptions. And those are really designed as a means to what we put them in a bucket is how information moves and how you can support the movement of them. So those two exceptions are designed to do that, to really think about what are the ways in which you can charge fees and the appropriate ways to do that. And the same thing for the licensing component. So those are two additional areas where we thought about updating the language a bit as well. And I think folks will see that. Also, I think the compliance timeline, which is part of what Steve talked about, is we really wanted to consider making sure that implementation of the rule is as effective as possible and thinking about the time it takes to make sure things are in the right place at the right time. So you'll see that across that compliance timeline that Steve talked about, really thinking about the timeline, not just for the certification criteria and the components on that side, such as FHIR 4, et cetera, but also thinking about the timeline for information blocking. We want to give folks the time to consume, understand the rule, and then from there go full force into implementing it to make sure that patients and providers have what they need.
Excellent. Did you have a question, Roberta?
I did. When now that the rules are out and we're starting our, once the Federal Register comes in, are you the person that's going to be over the compliance when people are not compliant?
Well, you know, as most folks tend to say in policy, right, it depends. So it depends on what
hasn't taken you long.
So as Steve talked about, there's kind of two rules in one. So on the certification side of the house and the certification components,
right,
we put in place new conditions of certification that are required of the developers that come to us to be certified. And those are things related to their business practices, to making a secure standardized API available. All of those components, those fall under our certification program. So yes, we would make sure that compliance is in place. On the information blocking side of the house, some of that falls with our partners at HHS, such as OIG, for example. Yep. So there you'll see OIG would be more involved, and we talk about that a little bit. And then I think overall we think about how we work together, and that's something that we've always done. So you'll see that there Congress actually laid out in the Cures Act that the information blocking component is not only a requirement under what we call 4004, which is a section in the Cures Act, but it's also something that's required of certified health IT developers, that they don't information block. So there could be situations where ONC is stepping in that component as well. So it depends and would be a balance. But our goal is always to make sure we are very clear and aligned in terms of how we are approaching those components.
Terrific. And I know we're still waiting on a little bit of the teeth, right? We're still waiting for some more, some additional, I don't know if it's rule or content or guidance on, you know, some of the teeth to this rule. Is that correct?
Yes. OIG is working on a rule that will be coming out hopefully soon. So they'll be looking, so you'll see more of that enforcement or the teeth, as you say, as part of that component. And that would come from OIG.
Will that start as a proposed rule?
Yes, it would be a proposed rule for comment first, and then right, you know, from there, they'll consider the comments and the feedback in the same way we do. We did, I should say, yep, with our notice of proposed rulemaking.
Excellent. Terrific. Well, Elise, you're always an amazing guest, very succinct, very crystal clear with a very complex topic. So we truly appreciate you joining us today and being a wonderful guest as always.
Happy to do it. And thank you so much. And thank you again to everyone who has engaged with us throughout this process. We look forward to the next step.
You got it. And for one last plug, I will give you healthit.gov/CuresRule.
Cures Rule. Nice and simple. Yeah.
You got it. If you haven't visited the website, please check it out, because this is going to transform our industry. It's going to unleash data. It's going to allow for innovation, turn innovation on its head in a lot of areas, add transparency, increase patient access. So from that standpoint, I'm extremely excited for what you guys are doing and what we have. So
wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Elise. Take care. Have a great afternoon. Next guest, Catherine Marchesini, Chief Privacy Officer from ONC. Are you there, Catherine?
Hi, Justin. Yes, how are you?
Fantastic. I'm terrific, and welcome back to the show. Grateful for your time.
Glad to be back.
Thank you. So as we've been doing, as you may have heard, kind of giving you the floor, I know there's some real key points from your perspective that you want to share. So I'm going to give you the floor, and then we'll do some follow-up based on what you shared. So is that fair? Is that good?
Sounds great. Thanks, Justin.
All right. The floor is yours.
Yeah, appreciate it. So I think since I've been last on your show with my colleagues, mm-hmm. There's been a continued and resounding support for most in industries for patients to get access to their health information, as you mentioned, Justin.
Yep.
Not only just their health information, but their health records. And so particularly for our purposes at ONC, we've been spending a lot of time looking at patients getting electronic access to the record so they can receive it and share it with whomever they want, however they want. This includes personal mobile health applications. So, you know, as I shared when we spoke previously, we see that providing individuals with easy access to their health information empowers them, as you heard Dr. Rucker speak earlier about, you know, controlling their decisions regarding their health and spending and costs and their overall care. I know you had mentioned, I've been listening in, that you've seen our final rule, and As listeners can probably attest to, we remain committed to providing individuals with the opportunity to receive electronic access to their health information, as well as giving patients choice. So generally, from ONC's role, this deals a lot with patients' access and the portability of their data. This includes selecting which data elements they want to share, which, you know, what do they want to transmit to a third party outside of their healthcare provider's control. For a healthcare provider, the final rule actually will allow providers to use technology to automate, as well as support the existing HIPAA right of access. Mm-hmm. So ideally, it should make it more convenient for patients, as well as allowing healthcare providers to work with developers to implement the HIPAA right of access. I did want to share that a little over a month ago, we at ONC had our annual meeting, and we actually had a patient-focused access panel discussion. So this was before the rule was out. There was a large discussion around the underlying benefits for patient access, but there also was a discussion about concerns that might exist, particularly around when a patient chooses to share information with a third-party app, for example. So I wanted to share that, you know, we at ONC respect the public calls for privacy protections and industry taking actions. From my perspective, concerns around the data uses by those that patients choose to receive data on their behalf, they're valid. This is part of a national discussion around the secondary uses of data and apps that actually extends beyond healthcare. So there is this wider discussion about data privacy, stewardship, and data, when there should be regulatory interventions to protect that data. So through the ONC Cures final rule, we tried to strike the right balance and trying to find, between the patient's right of access to more information so they can make decisions about their care and the data use concerns. And so we worked to build in specific technical requirements that would empower individuals to make choices. And they actually are making the choices to share, as well as provisions that allow for information blocking actors to educate and advise individuals about privacy and security protections or risk that the third-party applications might pose. So just wanted to kind of focus the conversation there and happy to answer any other questions.
Yeah, I'm going to ask one just on the consumerism side, because it's one of my, where my passions have kind of evolved over the past 5 to 10 years in healthcare. So this certainly enables consumerism in some capacities, but this is still also a very complex and complicated topic for a standard consumer to get their head around. So do you have a simple way to explain that to the average consumer of healthcare? Obviously, consumers are becoming much more informed. They're paying more for the healthcare than they ever have before. So they're self-educating, which is great. It's a good first step. But this is a complex topic. And so we can get, I'm sure Roberta's going to do a follow-up on the from a health IT vendor perspective. But from a consumer perspective, the average consumer, which I have a lot more of those now listening to my show than ever before, just to navigate healthcare on their own, what would you say to them? How does this rule... how could you simply explain to them this new rule or how this rule benefits them?
It's a great question. And it makes me think a little bit about, it's almost like a different take on health literacy.
Mm-hmm.
But in having to explain it, it's currently you as an individual have a legal right to electronically or digitally obtain all of your medical records from your healthcare provider in whatever form you choose.
Yes.
And your healthcare provider, if they're using certified health IT technology, they should have that capability and it should be easy for them to do with no additional cost. The question about, and I'm not sure if this is where, included in your question, but I would touch on, there is, as I mentioned earlier, there is the concern around, we've heard from stakeholders that, individuals, consumers, patients may not fully understand that when they receive their data or when they get their medical records from their healthcare provider and they might share it with someone or something, that information is not as protected as it would have been had it stayed with their healthcare provider. And what I would say to them is just know that even prior to our rule being released, there is a strong interest and support by industry groups that are encouraging healthcare companies, app developers, to what we would call self-regulate.
Yes.
But to a consumer, it would be, there are folks out there that are really trying to look after the consumers and trying to get folks to voluntarily adhere to what are called codes of conduct or guidelines. And really trying to encourage education, transparency, much like in our role, we allow for healthcare providers to partner with health app organizations to really try to educate. Because from my perspective, it's we all have a role to play. And we at ONC are trying to do our part, and I'm just hopeful that others would step up to the challenge.
Yeah, that is actually terrific. And I couldn't agree with you where you closed there with most companies, you know, they do follow self-regulation, at least from what I've been able to see, certainly the innovative players. Nobody wants a breach. Nobody wants to create a breach. They don't be a part of it. It probably be the end of your company in today's day and age. So at least if it's a smaller organization. So, I mean, people really do do their very best on the sides of codes of conduct and hopefully transparency, or at least, you know, these types of shows, these conversations, we educate people to do that. So thank you for bringing that up. Roberta, what would you have as a follow-up question?
So privacy really has been the key component, the people that are against. And so I've read some things, and people are saying that they think that there needs to be some new privacy laws put in place, or at least addressed. Is that something that you agree with, or that you think is a conversation there?
So I'd say yes and yes.
Okay.
We actually at ONC, the High Tech Act of 2009 actually required us to issue a report to Congress on this specific issue, HIPAA non-covered entity. So we actually would support that this conversation continue. As mentioned earlier, I mean, the concerns around data use are not unique to healthcare. I think that, you know, there are existing national conversations that are happening, and I think in the future that those would probably either accelerate or become more focused in that when looking at how organizations, entities that are not currently subject to regulatory regimes or any type of requirements, be it healthcare, not in healthcare, because you know, information about your health can be derived from many things. And so I think that we as an organization, as well as the United, you know, within the U.S., really need to look at how we are tackling the data use of information across industries.
I also noticed yesterday the FTC came out with a statement on your roles, and you actually agreed with them on Twitter. Can you explain that to us?
Yes, I know that we at ONC received a lot of stakeholder interest and feedback that wanting ONC to go further in type of regulating mobile apps and trying to get into the space of consumer protection. We as a federal department, we respect our other federal agencies' authority, and that to the extent there's concerns around data use and broader consumer protection across industry, not just health. Just as a reminder that the FTC currently has jurisdiction over consumer protection issues, of which the non-HIPAA-covered entity kind of discussion would already fall into. I would be remiss, though, if I wouldn't, you know, speak to there are interests and concern in industry as to whether the FTC's current jurisdiction and authority is strong enough, or if there's a need to create some other type of mechanism, because right now the only way, generally speaking, that the FTC is able to enforce or protect against certain type of actions, it's only as a result of a actor or an organization making promises that the FTC can then enforce against.
That's excellent. That's a great point. Catherine Marcicini, thank you so much. You're always an amazing guest, obviously an important topic and growing every single day in healthcare, which is a wonderful thing. So,
thank you, Justin Roberto, for your time. Appreciate it.
You got it. Thank you. Chief Privacy Officer, ONC, Catherine Marcicini. Again, thank you. All right. So, thank you again to all of you listeners. Without you, we wouldn't have a show. So thank you for joining us today. And as always, you can tune into This Justin Radio weekdays at 2:30 p.m. Eastern, 11:30 a.m. Pacific. You can go to thisjustinradio.com or healthcarenowradio.com. facebook.com/thisjustin, and you can hear our show broadcast again daily. As always, you can track me on Twitter at HIT Advisor and use the hashtag ThisJustinRadio so we can respond to your comments from the show. If you miss any of this broadcast or want to hear more, my shows are always posted on Apple iTunes, SoundCloud, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, Google Play, and TuneIn. Thanks, everyone. Have a terrific rest of your day.